He was the kind of coworker people called refreshing. Always smiling, always offering to help, always saying my name like we were friends. The sort of man who clapped the loudest when you spoke up in a meeting, who leaned back afterward and told everyone you were exactly what this team needed. And for a while, I believed him. Because praise is a drug when you're new, when you're trying to earn your place, when you're still deciding whether you deserve the seat you're sitting in. I didn't realize the applause was part of the trap, that the compliments were the mask, that while he was building me up in public, he was quietly loosening the screws behind the scenes, turning small mistakes into patterns, turning my competence into a question mark. It wasn't loud. It wasn't dramatic. It was worse than that. It was slow. And he never stopped smiling. I took the job because I was tired of chaotic places that ran on moods instead of process. I'd spent years moving through different workplaces, learning how power looks when it's subtle, and how cruelty can be dressed up as culture. By the time I landed at Valette & Cie, I wanted something clean, structured, French in the way people imagine French offices to be, polished, precise, controlled. It was a mid-sized firm that handled compliance and risk consulting for clients who liked to say, regulatory alignment, instead of were afraid of getting fined. Glass walls, quiet shoes, coffee that tasted like it had been chosen by committee. People who dressed like they didn't sweat. The team I joined sat on the fifth floor, in an open-plan space that pretended to be modern but still felt like surveillance. You could see everyone. You could hear everything, if you learned to listen the right way. The only real privacy belonged to the directors, behind doors that stayed closed until someone needed to be summoned. I was hired as a senior analyst, which sounded more powerful than it was. It meant I was good at translating messy reality into reports that clients could read without panicking. It meant I could run a project without constant supervision. It also meant I wasn't part of the old friendships yet. I wasn't part of the stories. My manager, Claire, was a white French woman who wore her authority like jewelry, beautiful, expensive, and easy to notice. She was competent, sharp, and permanently tired, the kind of woman who had learned to survive by being twice as prepared and half as emotional as anyone expected. She liked me immediately, but not warmly, more like she'd looked at my CV and decided I could carry weight. The first week was onboarding and observation. I listened more than I spoke. I watched where people placed themselves in meetings. Who got interrupted? Who got credit? Who got ignored? I watched the little rituals that told you what mattered. The laugh that meant agreement. The silence that meant punishment. The way people avoided certain names. And then, there was him. Julien, white French man. Mid-30s, maybe. Not handsome in a cinematic way, but attractive in an office way. Well-groomed, fit, clean lines. Always looked like he'd slept. His smile was practiced, but not fake. That's what made it dangerous. It wasn't a grin. It was warmth. Like he had time for you. Like you were safe. He was the first person to say, if you need anything, just ask. And he didn't say it like a corporate slogan. He said it like a friend. The second week, he did something that made me feel seen. We were in a team meeting with Claire and two directors. I had been asked to present a risk summary for a new client in renewable energy. I'd spent the weekend building a clean narrative, because I knew how quickly people would blame an analyst if something didn't land well. I spoke. People nodded. One director asked a question that was half genuine and half performance. I answered. Julien leaned forward, eyes on me, like he was impressed. When I finished, he smiled and said, "That's exactly the kind of clarity we've been missing. She makes it simple without dumbing it down." It was a small thing, a compliment, but it landed with a thud in my chest. In a room where people loved to take credit and rarely offered praise, it said something supportive and specific. After the meeting, he walked with me toward the elevators. He kept the conversation light, asked how I was settling in, said he admired how I handled pressure, said he'd been here long enough to know how hard it is to win trust. And then, as we waited for the lift, he said something that sounded like mentorship. "Just one thing," he said, still smiling. "Be careful with Claire. She likes strong people, but she hates surprises. Always keep her looped in, even if it's boring." I nodded. It sounded reasonable. And it made him sound like he cared. That's what I didn't understand yet. The sabotage doesn't start with damage. It starts with positioning. It starts with trust. Within a month, Julian was everywhere in my work life, but in a way that felt accidental. He'd appear in the kitchen when I was making coffee and mention something about a client issue that conveniently aligned with what I was working on. He'd tag me in internal threads praising my input. He'd offer to review decks before I sent them to Claire, the way people do when they're being supportive. And because I was trying to integrate, because I was still learning the internal rhythm, I let him. He never took anything from me directly. Not at first. He made it feel like he was giving. The first warning sign came wrapped as kindness. I had prepared a draft report for a client and sent it to Julian because he'd insisted he was familiar with their expectations. He replied quickly with track changes and a message that said, "Great work. I tightened a few points. You'll thank me later." I opened the document and felt my face get hot. He hadn't tightened. He'd rewritten sections in his voice. He'd softened conclusions I'd supported with evidence. He'd changed the framing in ways that made the risk look less urgent, more palatable. Part of me thought, maybe he knows something I don't. Maybe the client prefers gentle language. Maybe this is how they do it here. But another part of me, older, quieter, felt a small discomfort that didn't have a name yet. It felt like being guided by the elbow toward a direction you didn't choose. I decided not to overreact. I kept some of his edits, rejected others, and sent the report to Claire with a note explaining the reasoning. Claire replied with a short thanks and nothing else. No praise, no pushback, neutral. Julian messaged me separately. "Perfect. You're learning fast." That sentence should have annoyed me. It implied I was a student and he was the teacher. But I told myself it was just his personality. The firm was full of people who liked to be in control. Then small things started to go missing. Not physically, conceptually. A point I made in a meeting would be echoed later by Julien, with slightly better timing, slightly more confidence. And somehow, the room would react to it like it was new. A client would ask a question, and Claire would turn to Julian, not to me, even when I'd built the analysis. At first, I blamed myself. Maybe I wasn't asserting enough. Maybe I wasn't visible enough. I'd seen this pattern before: the woman who does the work, the man who speaks it. It's common enough that you learn to anticipate it. But Julian wasn't doing it openly. That's what made it hard to name. He would praise me in public while absorbing the credit in private. He would compliment my presentation and then send a message to Claire afterward with a few concerns about the way I framed something. I didn't see those messages. Not yet. I only felt the results. Claire's subtle shift. The way her questions became sharper. The way her trust felt conditional. One afternoon, Claire asked me to join her in a small meeting room. Her tone was polite. Her face was controlled. "I want to talk about the Verdun account," she said. Verdun was one of my projects. Complicated. High pressure. A client with a habit of changing their mind and blaming everyone else for it. I'd been holding it together. "What about it?" I asked. Claire looked at me for a beat too long, like she was measuring something. "I've heard you've been struggling with responsiveness," she said. My stomach dropped, but my voice stayed steady. "Struggling?" She tilted her head slightly. "Late updates. Not keeping stakeholders aligned. People feeling unsure. People. Quo." It was vague, which is how criticism gets delivered when the critic doesn't want to be accountable. I said, "I send weekly updates, I've been escalating issues. If someone feels unsure, I'd like to know what they're missing. Claire's expression didn't soften. It's not about the content of your updates. It's about perception. That word, proactive. It's a weapon when someone wants you to feel guilty for not reading minds. I asked her, calmly, who had raised the concern. She didn't answer directly. It came up. In the hallway afterward, I stood in front of the bathroom mirror and stared at my own face like it belonged to someone else. I wasn't angry yet. I was confused. That's the first stage of sabotage, confusion. It makes you doubt your instincts. Julian found me later at my desk and leaned on the divider like we were close. I heard Claire talk to you, he said gently. My eyes narrowed. You heard? He shrugged, the perfect mix of concern and innocence. She worries. You're talented. She wants you to succeed. I didn't like the way he said worries, like I was a delicate thing that might break. I said, did you say something to her? His smile didn't change, but something in his eyes did. A flicker, not fear, calculation. Of course not, he said. I'm on your side. Then he added, as if he couldn't help himself. But you do need to be careful. Some people interpret confidence as arrogance. There it was. The subtle suggestion that the problem wasn't my work, it was my personality. That I should make myself smaller to survive. I wanted to push back, but I didn't want to look defensive. That's another trap. When someone is undermining you, any resistance can be framed as proof you're unstable. So I smiled politely, thanked him, and went back to my screen. I tried to swallow the feeling like it was nothing. But over the next few weeks, the contradiction sharpened. Julianne would compliment me in meetings. Excellent analysis, really. And then, later, I'd notice Claire assigned pieces of my work to someone else to support me. Julianne would casually mention that he'd taken care of something I hadn't asked him to touch. The office began to feel like a place where the ground moved slightly beneath my feet every day. Not enough to knock me down, but enough to make me watch my footing constantly. And that constant vigilance, the effort of staying upright while someone quietly tilts the floor, was exhausting. I started arriving earlier, leaving later, writing more detailed emails, adding more people in CC, because I needed a trail. I needed proof that I was doing what I said I was doing. But building proof changes you. It makes you less present. It makes you more rigid. It makes you colder, because you're always thinking about how something might be used against you later. I didn't know it yet, but Julianne had already won something important. He'd made me behave like I was guilty. The first time I caught him, it wasn't traumatic. It was banal. Which is often the point. The worst things in workplaces rarely look like movies. They look like Outlook. I was preparing a deck for a client update. Tight timeline. High visibility. Claire wanted it on her desk before noon. I'd been working since early morning, refining numbers, aligning the narrative. I sent the draft to Claire and, out of habit, copied Julian because he'd been supporting on the account. 10 minutes later, I got a reply from Claire. Not to me. To Julian. I saw it because I was still on the thread. I watched the notification pop up like a small humiliation. Claire wrote, "Thanks, Julian. Looks good. I'll use this version." I stared at the screen, waiting for my brain to catch up. Use this version? Julian had responded privately to Claire with an edited deck. My deck, with his name on the file. It wasn't just that he changed slides. It was that he positioned himself as the deliverer, the handler, the reliable one. I opened the attachment. It was my work with cosmetic tweaks. A few words softened, a chart reordered, one slide rearranged to look cleaner, and his initials in the footer of the title slide. My hands went cold. I didn't storm into his office. I didn't slam anything down. I didn't do what my body wanted, which was to make noise. Because noise gets punished. Instead, I walked to the kitchen and poured myself water I didn't drink. I stood there, breathing slowly, trying to decide whether this was worth confronting, trying to decide what the consequences would be if I did. This is what people don't understand about sabotage. It's not just the act. It's the calculation it forces you into. It makes you spend your energy not on work, but on strategy. When I came back, Shilen was at his desk, typing like he was innocent. When he saw me, he smiled. "Hey," he said, casual. "How are you holding up? Big morning." I sat down, opened my laptop, and forced my voice to stay level. "I saw the email," I said. He blinked once. "What email?" I turned my screen slightly, not aggressively, just enough. His expression didn't change much. It was almost impressive. He leaned in, like he was seeing it for the first time. "Oh," he said, "that. Claire asked me to make a few formatting adjustments. She likes things a certain way. I didn't want you to stress." He said it like he'd done me a favor. I looked at him. "Why didn't you tell me you were sending it as your version?" His smile stayed, but the warmth evaporated. "It's not about ownership," he said softly. "It's about the client getting what they need." That sentence was designed to make me sound petty if I argued, like I cared about credit instead of outcomes. I tried a different angle. "It has your initials in the footer." He laughed lightly, like I was being cute. "Oh, that? That's just the template I use. I didn't even notice." He shrugged, and it was such a small shrug, but it carried a message. "You can't prove intent." I felt something tighten in my chest. I could feel the part of me that wanted to believe him, fighting with the part that knew better. "I'd like you not to do that again," I said. He leaned back, still smiling, but now it was a thin smile, all teeth. "Of course," he said, "if that makes you comfortable. If that makes you comfortable. Not if that's right. Not if that's fair. Comfort. As if my concern was emotional, not rational." After that day, he got bolder. Or maybe he didn't get bolder. Maybe I just started seeing him clearly. He would offer to help, and then forward my work upward as if it were his stewardship. He would ask questions in meetings that sounded supportive, but were actually designed to expose gaps. He would say things like, "Just to clarify, did we validate that figure?" while looking directly at me, in front of everyone. And if I hesitated for even a second, he'd tilt his head and smile like he was concerned. The room would watch, Claire would watch, and I'd feel my credibility leak out in real time. I started documenting everything. I kept drafts, I saved email threads. I stopped sending him anything unless I had to. When he asked for files, I'd reply with, "I'll send it to Claire directly," or, "Let's review together," because I didn't want him alone with my work. He didn't like that. He didn't confront me directly. He didn't have to. He adjusted his tone around me. He became slightly cooler in private, slightly more enthusiastic in public. It was theater. The way a predator performs friendliness so no one believes the prey when she finally screams. One Friday afternoon, Claire scheduled a project review. We were in one of the glass meeting rooms. The walls were transparent, which meant everyone could see you if they looked, even if they couldn't hear. It created this feeling of being on display, like your body language was part of your performance review. Claire sat at the head of the table. Julian sat beside her, angled toward her like a trusted advisor. I sat across, laptop open, ready. We reviewed timelines, deliverables, client feedback. And Claire said, "There's concern that the Verdon team is fragmented." I felt my jaw tense. Fragmented how? Claire glanced at Julian. He nodded slightly, as if giving her permission to continue. "I've heard mixed messages are going out," she said. "Confusion about priorities." I kept my voice calm. "All messaging has been aligned through the weekly update emails. If there's confusion, I can forward the thread." Julianne leaned in, smiling gently. "I don't think anyone doubts you're working hard," he said. "It's just, sometimes the way you phrase things can sound definitive when the situation is still evolving." I stared at him. "Because I recognize that tactic. Criticize your tone. Make your communication style the problem. Make it subjective." Claire nodded as if he'd said something wise. "Yes," she said. "That's what I mean. We need to be careful." I wanted to ask, careful of what? The truth? The client seeing risk? But I also knew that if I pushed too hard, I'd be labeled difficult, defensive, uncollaborative. So I swallowed it. I agreed to adjust phrasing. I agreed to add Julien into more coordination, which was exactly what he wanted. More access, more proximity to the narrative. After the meeting, I sat at my desk feeling like I'd swallowed a stone. That's the part people don't talk about. How sabotage makes you complicit in your own diminishing. Not because you want to be, because you're trying to survive. The next escalation came through something even more corrosive than stolen credit. Reputation. I started noticing that people spoke to me differently. Not rude, not openly, just careful. Like I might react badly. Like I might be unstable. A colleague I barely knew, Sophie, stopped by my desk one morning and said, softly, "Are you okay?" I blinked. "Yes. Why?" She hesitated. "You seem stressed." I was stressed, but I wasn't showing it more than anyone else. Not until I began being treated like a problem. "What did you hear?" I asked, keeping my voice light. She shrugged quickly. "Nothing. Just, you know, people talk. People talk." That phrase was like a crack in a wall that lets you see the rot behind it. Later that day, I overheard Julien in the corridor near the printers. He was talking to another consultant, laughing gently. I didn't catch every word, but I heard my name, and I heard him say, in that warm, sympathetic tone, "She's brilliant, honestly, but she takes things personally. You have to be careful how you approach her." I stood frozen behind the corner, heart pounding, not because I was shocked, but because it confirmed everything. He was building a narrative that I was talented but unstable, that any pushback from me was proof of sensitivity, that any complaint was emotional. It was genius in a disgusting way, because it inoculated him against accountability. If I accused him, people would think, "See, she's taking it personally." I went back to my desk and typed an email to Claire. I deleted it. I typed another. I deleted it. I considered going directly to HR, but Valette and C treated HR like a fire extinguisher you only used after the building was already burning. And even then, they'd ask why you started the fire. So I did what women often do in these situations. I tried to outwork it. I became impeccable. I made my work unassailable. I anticipated questions before they came. I double-checked everything. I wrote emails that were clear enough to be used as evidence. I kept my tone neutral, even when I wanted to scream. And Julien responded by becoming even more charming. He started praising me more publicly. He'd say, "We're lucky to have her," in meetings, smiling directly at me. People would smile back. Claire would look pleased. Sometimes, after those moments, I'd catch a flicker in his face, something that looked like enjoyment. Like he liked being able to lift me and crush me at the same time. One evening, after most people had left, Julien walked by my desk and stopped. "You're still here," he said, soft. I didn't look up right away. "Yes." He leaned closer, lowering his voice like we were intimate. "You don't have to fight so hard." That sentence hit me like a hand on my throat. I looked at him then, properly. "I'm not fighting," I said. He smiled, slow. "Of course you are," he said. "You're trying to prove something." I felt heat rise in my cheeks. "What are you doing, Julien?" His smile widened slightly. "I'm trying to help you," he said. "But you're making it difficult." There it was again. The inversion. His sabotage framed as help. My resistance framed as difficulty. He straightened, and for a moment, his mask slipped. "Just a little. Claire likes me," he said quietly, almost casually. "She trusts me." "You should think about that before you make things uncomfortable." He didn't threaten me explicitly. He didn't have to. The implication hung in the air. Then he smiled again and walked away like he'd said something harmless. I sat there, hands on the keyboard, unable to type. Because now it wasn't just about work. It was about power. And he was telling me without raising his voice that he had more. The breaking point wasn't a single act. It was the accumulation finally becoming visible enough that I could hold it in my hands and call it what it was. It happened on a Tuesday, early January, when everyone was back from holidays pretending they'd rested. The office smelled like new planners and old anxiety. We had a client escalation meeting, high stakes, directors involved. Claire asked me to prepare the risk response plan and circulate it beforehand. I did. I sent it at 8:12 a.m. to Claire, the directors, and Julian, because by then he was embedded in everything, whether I liked it or not. The plan was solid. Clear actions. OIR assignments. Timeline. It was the kind of thing that should have quieted the room. At 9:03, Julian replied all. He attached a revised version. And in the body of the email he wrote, "I've streamlined the plan to align with leadership expectations. Please see attached. Leadership expectations." As if my version wasn't aligned. As if I didn't understand what leadership wanted. As if he had translated my work into something acceptable. I stared at the email and felt something inside me go very still. Not rage, not panic. Clarity. Because he'd done it in front of everyone now. Not hidden, not private. I opened his attachment. He'd removed my name from the header. He'd changed the tone to be softer, less urgent. He'd reassigned key tasks to himself. He'd made it look like he was the central operator. And then I saw the most insulting detail. He'd left a sentence I wrote almost word for word, but changed one adjective, as if to make it his. I could have replied with anger. I could have called him out in the thread. But I knew how he'd use that. He'd smile and say, "Let's not get emotional." He'd frame me as unstable in front of the directors. So I did something different. I replied all, but I kept my tone clean, almost boring. I wrote, "Thanks, Julian. For clarity, the attached revision is based on my original plan sent at 8:12. I've reattached my version below with tracked changes comparison for transparency. We can decide which version to use in the meeting." I attached my original. I attached a tracked changes comparison document that showed, line by line, what he changed. I didn't accuse. I didn't insult. I didn't name sabotage. I made it visible. That's the thing people like Julian hate most. Not confrontation. Visibility. For 5 minutes, nothing happened. The office hummed. I could hear keyboards. I could hear the distant sound of someone laughing near the coffee machine. Then Claire replied. Not to me. Not to him. To the thread. Understood. We'll use the original plan and discuss revisions live. Short. Neutral. Controlled. But it was enough. It was a denial of his claim to be the translator of leadership. I watched Julian from my desk. He didn't look at me. He didn't move much. His jaw tightened slightly. His smile was gone. In the meeting, something shifted. The directors asked questions directly to me. They referenced my document. Julian tried to speak over a few points, but Claire cut him off once, lightly, saying, "Let her finish." It was small. Almost nothing. But when you've been suffocating quietly, A small opening feels like air. Afterward, Julien approached me, near the elevators. He was smiling again, but it was a different smile now. Not warmth, not friendliness. A smile, with teeth. "That was interesting," he said. I kept my voice calm. I wanted transparency. He tilted his head. "You realize how that looks, right?" I stared at him. "How does it look?" He leaned in slightly, lowering his voice, intimate again. "Like you don't trust the team," he said. "Like you're creating drama." I almost laughed. Not because it was funny, because it was so predictable. "I'm documenting work," I said. "That's not drama." His eyes flicked over my face, like he was searching for a crack. "Claire won't like this," he said softly. "I think Claire likes results," I said. His smile faltered for half a second. Then he straightened, and the warmth returned like a curtain dropping back into place. "Anyway," he said, breezy again, "lunch?" As if we were friends. As if nothing had happened. That's what made him unsettling. He could switch from threat to charm like flipping a coin. I didn't go to lunch with him. I went to Claire's office. I didn't announce myself dramatically. I knocked, waited, and stepped inside when she said yes. She looked up from her screen, expression unreadable. I sat down without asking. I could feel my heart beating hard, but my voice stayed steady. "I need to talk about Julien," I said. Claire's eyes narrowed slightly. "What about him?" I didn't tell her a story. I didn't lead with emotion. I did what the office demanded. I brought receipts. I showed her the email chain. I showed her the comparison document. I showed her a pattern. Instances where Julien forwarded my work upward as his. Instances where he altered documents without telling me. Instances where he inserted himself as owner. Claire looked at the material quietly. She didn't react the way I wanted her to. She didn't look shocked. She didn't look angry. She looked tired. When she finally spoke, she said, "Why are you bringing this now?" That question made my stomach twist, because it implied the problem was timing, not behavior. "Because it's escalating," I said, "and it's affecting my credibility." Claire leaned back, exhaling. "Julien is complicated," she said. "Complicated. A euphemism that protects the person doing harm." "I'm not asking you to like me more," I said. "I'm asking for boundaries. Clear ownership. No rewriting without agreement. No presenting my work as his." Claire studied me for a moment, and something softened, just slightly. "You're good," she said. "That's why this is happening." I didn't know whether to feel validated or furious. Claire continued. "Julien likes control. He likes being seen as indispensable. I've managed him for years. He's useful, but he's territorial."
"Territorial?"
"As if I were a desk plant he didn't want moved." "So what do we do?" I asked. Claire's eyes flicked toward the glass wall, where the office could see her if they looked. She lowered her voice. "I'll handle it," she said. I wanted to believe her. I wanted that sentence to be a shield. But I'd been in enough workplaces to know that "I'll handle it" can mean a lot of things, including "I'll make it quieter." Over the next month, the sabotage changed shape. Julien stopped stealing my work openly. He stopped replying all with revisions. He started working in shadows again. He would schedule calls with clients and summarize them afterward in ways that framed me as absent. He would smile at me in the hallway like nothing had ever been wrong. And the office, sensing conflict, did what offices do. They avoided. People stopped mentioning Julien around me. They stopped asking if I was okay. They treated me like someone you didn't want to get too close to, because you might get pulled into the mess. That isolation was its own punishment. One day, Claire told me she decided to move me to a different account for strategic reasons. Strategic, another euphemism. I understood immediately. It was easier to move me than to confront him in a way that would disrupt the team's comfort. It wasn't a demotion. On paper, it was even a step up. Bigger client, more visibility. But it was also a removal. A way to protect the system without admitting anything had been wrong. Julian still smiled at me after that. In meetings, he'd compliment me occasionally. As if you'd always been supportive. "She's really strong," he'd say. "She's resilient." Resilient. Another word people use when they've put you through something they don't want to name. I lasted 6 more months at Valette NC. I delivered. I built new relationships. I did good work. I learned to function with the residue of what had happened. But something inside me had changed. I used to walk into offices assuming competence would speak for itself, assuming professionalism meant safety, assuming people who smiled at you meant well. After Julie, I stopped assuming. I started reading smiles differently. I started watching who praised you publicly and what they did privately. I started noticing how often compliments were used like currency, how people would spend them to buy access. Sometimes, even now, I catch myself hesitating before I send an email. I add a person in CC, even when it feels unnecessary. I attach a previous version of a document just in case. That's what he left me with, not trauma in a dramatic sense, not tears in the bathroom every day. Something quieter. A reflex to protect myself from someone wearing a friendly face. And the worst part is, if you ask the office who Julian was, they'd still describe him the same way. Freshing. Helpful. Always smiling. And if you asked them about me, they'd say, softly, like they were being kind, "She's brilliant." But she takes things personally.